Hello and welcome to Plymouth Beneath the Surface, where we will meet inspiring people from Plymouth that have oriented their lives and careers around the ocean. Are you ready to dive into Plymouth waters to explore career options, discover underwater ecosystems, understand marine research and conservation initiatives? I'm your host, Ruza Sihan, a final year student in marine biology at the University of Plymouth. I'm really grateful to have you here today, and I hope you enjoy this dose of inspiration in this new episode. So welcome to this new episode of the podcast, and I'm with Louise Firth. Welcome. Can I ask you to introduce yourself, please?
Yes. So my name is Louise Firth, and I'm a lecturer in marine ecology at the University of Plymouth.
What do you study? What's your research?
Benthic marine ecology and community ecology, typically shallow water stuff, mostly intertidal, but I'm interested in how organisms interact with each other and their environment.
So how did you get there? What's your career path?
Oh, I fell in love with the west coast of Ireland through volunteering. There was a PhD student who was in the lab at the time, and she needed help setting up an experiment. I went along and helped her setting it up, and it was cages on the rocky shore, and it was manipulating densities of grazers and identities of grazers. And for me, it was the first time I actually had a real opportunity to actually see some experimental marine ecology. And it was drills and cages and, you know, screwing things onto the shore. And I was like, this is science? I was like, I can get on board with this. If this is science, it's not, you know, hardcore machinery in the lab and, you know, all high tech. It was stuff that you could buy in B&Q and manipulating biodiversity and then measuring the responses. I just thought, this is really cool. I can do this. Yeah.
So you studied in Ireland?
Yep. I did a BSc in zoology at University College Dublin. And I stayed on there to do my PhD in the same department. Following that, then I did a range of postdocs around the world in various different places before I eventually ended up here in Plymouth.
So how long have you been in Plymouth for?
Since January 2015.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Are you enjoying it?
I am. Yeah. No, I was very glad to stop. It was wonderful travelling around and, you know, visiting exotic places for postdocs, but I was ready to stop and actually make some real friends and, you know, have a permanent job and buy a house and all that. Yeah.
Right now, what's your main field of research?
There's lots of things on the go, but if I had to pick one thing, I would say it's eco-engineering, which is effectively combining ecological theory with engineering practice to make space for nature in the marine built environment. So we work with engineers and we create novel environments in seawalls and rock armor and breakwaters to try and encourage marine biota to colonize these environments.
Because we're losing natural environments more and more. Is that what you call like the ocean sprawl?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So ocean sprawl is effectively the proliferation of artificial structures in the marine environment. And in coastal environments, that's typically things like seawalls, rock armoring, marinas, ports. And in order to, you know, place these things, we're replacing natural habitats like mangroves, salt marshes, rocky shores with hard engineered structures, which are typically very species poor. They're poor habitat for marine life, and the knock-on effects on ecosystem functioning, so the functions that the organism would have been doing, is lost. So yeah, we try to sort of try and put some of that back in through eco-engineering.
So how do you bring back marine life into artificial structures?
Typically seawalls and rock armoring are very smooth, and they're often made of concrete and other artificial materials that are, you know, they're not good habitat for marine life. So very simply, we can create topographic complexity. So we put in roughness, nooks and crannies, any sort of water retention in that environment, and it creates habitats for marine life to settle into and hopefully thrive.
So have you been doing experiments like that in Plymouth?
Yep, we've run a few different experiments in Plymouth in different places. We've run a few on Plymouth Breakwater, which is always a bit of fun going out to the breakwater. But we've also done some on seawalls nearby in Sheldon, which is further along the coast. We have bioblocks at the marine station, which are these large concrete units that the ones at the marine station wouldn't be, you know, in the typical environment where they should be. They're more for show and for, you know, for outreach purposes. But yeah, it gives you an idea of the kind of units that could be used in a in a breakwater or a coastal defence structure.
And what types of organisms can you find in these structures? Are they the same that you can find on the shore?
Yeah, lots of similar species that you'd find on natural shores, way more than you would find on the hard engineered structure without the interventions. So typically on a seawall or rock armour, you will get some seaweeds, you'll get some gastropods, you'll get some crabs running around, but typically they're very species poor. There's very few species that live in these kind of environments. As soon as you put in the nooks and crannies and water retention, many more species can survive in these areas that can't normally survive there. Typically, they would be similar ones that you would find on natural rocky shores. We wouldn't be bringing in anything new or novel in that sense.
Why is it important that we provide structure or habitat for these species?
If we continue developing and building the way we have in the past, there's going to be nothing left, unfortunately. There are many places around the world that are now claiming that, you know, even over 50% of their coastline is actually artificial. So places like Singapore, for instance, if you actually walk around the coastline of Singapore, 63% of it is now seawall, whereas in the past it would have been natural beaches, it would have been mangroves, it would have been mudflats. These are now seawalls. You're getting a lot of habitat loss with that, and with habitat loss you're going to lose the species that are associated with them. This is a global problem and it's huge. Places like China are replacing a lot of their natural environments with really, really large engineered seawalls. And we just can't keep building them in the traditional way. We now realise, you know, that we're losing these habitats and species, and we have to do something about it. So yeah, I think it's quite important that we do this. It is in no way replacing or making up for the loss of those habitats, but it's a step in the right direction, and it's trying to put some functions and ecosystem services back into these environments. It's not making up for what we're losing though.
And can you use eco-engineering structures to make artificial reefs as well? Or are you more doing on like the coastal constructions?
They're similar, and the concepts are very similar. I try to keep the concept of artificial reefs quite separate to the kind of work that I do personally. Artificial reefs are typically constructed for very particular purposes, whether it's fisheries enhancement or whether it's to prevent trawling in an area or whether it's to compensate for biodiversity loss somewhere else as part of development. So there's usually very specific reasons why artificial reefs are built. The concepts and, you know, what happens on an artificial reef in terms of encouraging marine life, that's similar. So when we do this on coastal defences and seawalls, you know, it's a similar concept. But yeah, I try to keep them separate, if you know what I mean.
You study historical ecology, which I find really interesting. Can you tell us a bit more about what it is?
Sure. Yeah, it's a relatively new string to my bow over the last few years. But when I first realised this was a thing, I was like, yes, this is so cool. I love it. I've always been quite interested in history anyway. And of course, I'm obviously interested in biology and the environment. You can combine the two. It's a thing. It's a real science. And there's some really exciting, interesting questions that you can ask with this. It can often require a bit of Indiana Jones attitude and outlook, but it's looking into the past. So historical ecology or environmental history, they're similar fields. It's looking at how the human interaction with the environment has changed over time. So how we, you know, how we used to treat the environment and how, you know, we used to interact with it. You know, how has that changed and what are our attitudes like now today? Depleting fisheries, for instance, and our attitudes to that, how that's changed.
So how has it changed?
It really depends on what you're looking at. So for instance, with fish, you know, we used to sort of view fish as an inexhaustible resource that was just there. Huxley from the Marine Biological Association very famously said, you know, this is an inexhaustible resource. We can just keep fishing as we are and it'll be okay. I'm sorry, but he was wrong. He was amazing, but he was wrong. So, you know, our attitude to fish has completely changed. We now have, you know, the common fisheries policy. We now have quotas. You know, we treat fish and fishing very differently. But equally, other things have changed. We probably have more negative views of things in some ways. It depends on the sort of thing that you're looking at. I mean, one of the ones that I like, I think is really a really good example, is wetlands. In the past, we used to be afraid of wetlands. They were places of disease and darkness. You know, you often hear politicians in particular referring to drain the swamp. And it has this really sort of negative and even modern continuous negative association with wetlands. And of course, you know, most marine biologists today will appreciate mangroves and salt marshes are, you know, hugely productive, hugely important. But historically, we used to build over them and drain them. And, you know, they were seen very negatively. We've changed our attitudes and views.
And do you think we're changing attitudes right now in a more positive way? Is it coming where we start to appreciate the marine environment, like we, you know, with the deep sea, we're really starting to understand what it is?
Yeah, thankfully we're standing on the shoulders of giants now, and we know a lot more than we used to. And, you know, it's an iterative process. We're constantly learning, and new challenges and problems come along all the time during our learning. So climate change, you know, 50 years ago, people weren't really studying the effects of climate change on marine biology. Now, lots of people are studying it. So, you know, our focus changes over time, and our attitudes are changing because we have new challenges.
We are part of the problem and the solution. So I think understanding our relationship with the environment is kind of key to understand how we can as well find solutions.
Oh no, we're definitely part of the problem, but we have to be part of the solution.
What's driving you today to do this? Why do you think you're, you know, doing this type of research?
I love it. The research, I mean, it's a big job. There's, you know, there's so many different hats that you wear on different days. The research and teaching are the two big ones for me. I love research and I love teaching. Yeah, I love understanding the world that I live in. I love going to a new place. I love going to the shore. I love going to Dartmoor and actually understanding the things that I'm looking at. And there's a very famous quote from James Bond that a marine biologist is never on holidays. And that's so true. It's so true. I find it impossible to go on a holiday and not be taking pictures of the limpets or, you know, digging around and looking at things. I mean, you're constantly making observations. You're constantly coming up with hypotheses and thinking. And it just makes the world a fascinating place. So, yeah, it's for me, it's understanding the natural world and what's around me.
You touched on limpets. Can you tell us more about... I know you love them and I think we can't not talk about them. So can you tell us about limpets?
I sure can.
Well, don't ask too many times.
I started my research career working on limpets during my PhD, actually my undergrad project and then my PhD. But I learned during my PhD that they don't get the respect. They just don't. People laugh at them. People kick them off the rocks. People have even asked me during my PhD, like people got all excited when I said I was doing a PhD on marine biology. And they were like, oh, how cool. And they're like, are you studying whales or sharks or dolphins? And honestly, you should see their faces when I said limpets. Like, they literally dropped. And I've had people even say to me, what? Why? Like, why would you study them? Like, they're so boring. So I made it my personal mission to fly the flag for limpets. They are the underdog. Everyone loves mussels and cowries and oysters. Somebody needs to fly the flag for limpets, so I've made it my personal mission. I think I'm achieving it.
So why are they so cool?
Well, they're important for lots of different reasons. You know, we use ecosystem services as a way of sort of talking about how important species are. Ecosystem services is basically how we as humans perceive what we can get from nature is probably a way of looking at it. But we get food from them. So historically in the past, they were really important. If you do some reading around like middens all over the world, they're often the dominant shellfish in middens. So historically, they were hugely important as a food item. And they still are today in many parts of the world. They're considered a delicacy. In Hawaii, they're called the fish of death because people lose their lives every year fishing them because they're so lucrative and because they're so highly valued. Ecologically, they're hugely important. They're found on rocky shores globally. They have a very important function in terms of controlling the growth of algae, but they have, you know, various important interactions with many other species. But, you know, I've also sort of read around the sort of more cultural sides to limpets as well, and who knew that they were so important in culture, in folklore and superstitions and all sorts of other things. So there's a lot more to the limpet than people give them credit for.
Have you eaten limpets before?
I have, but I'm probably not the right person to ask if they're nice or not because I'm not really into shellfish.
Okay.
They're chewy. Well, you've eaten them. What do you think?
Yeah, I've eaten like ceviche of limpets.
Yeah.
It was really good. No, I liked it, but I asked that because I asked Dan as well. in the previous episode if you had tried kelp. I've heard someone saying that you should try the species that you study.
Yeah. Have you eaten kelp?
I have. Yeah. Chile of course. Ceviche of kelp.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about the honeycomb worm?
My second favourite species after limpets. Yeah, no, I've been working on this species for a few years now. So it's called the honeycomb worm. It's gregarious worm that you don't see one, you typically see thousands. They form reefs, so they make little tubes out of sand grains when the tide is in. And as they grow up over time, the reefs can actually get quite big. And in France, for instance, in Mont-Saint-Michel Bay, the reefs are taller than me and they cover hundreds of hectares. They're the largest reefs in Europe. So they can form really quite big and important structures. They're just really cool. They've very important functions. They provide habitat for lots of other species. And they're just beautiful to look at.
Have you always wanted to do research when you started your career, or like when you were doing your PhD? Did you know that you wanted to do research?
Yeah. I was very lucky, actually, even before my PhD. Before I did any you know, university study, I knew I wanted to be a marine biologist. So I am one of the lucky ones who actually sort of had a very clear goal in my head. But yes, as soon as I knew what a PhD was and I knew that you could actually make a career out of doing research, That was it for me. That's all I ever wanted. And when I had close interaction with lecturers during my third and my fourth year of my degree, I sort of got an insight into what the life of a lecturer was. And I was like, yeah, that's what I want to do. You know, you get to teach, you get to do research, you know, you get to, you know, work with all these people all over the world and, you know, get to work with, you know, students. It looked like the perfect job. And, you know, that was it then. That was the goal.
If you had any advice or tips to, you know, students that are listening, future students that probably want to do a degree in marine biology or current ones that are thinking about postgrad, or what would you tell them?
It would probably be the same piece of advice, no matter what stage somebody's at. Don't let people underestimate you. People will underestimate you all the way through your career. And I would just say, don't let them do that. You know yourself what you're capable of, and just believe in yourself and go for it. Don't let people tell you you're not capable. Don't let people tell you that, you know, marine biology is a hobby. It's not. It doesn't have to be a hobby. It could be. It's a great hobby, but it can be a career, and you have control over that. And I would just say, yeah, believe in yourself and go for it.
Yeah. You're looking at me when I said that, so it's pretty nice. And do you have any places around Plymouth or in Plymouth that you really like for the marine environment that you like to go to?
Yeah, we're lucky, aren't we, living in Plymouth? Don't tell people. I hope this isn't going to be an international podcast, is it? We want to keep it a secret. Plymouth is amazing. For an urban environment to have such amazing access to such an incredible coastline and diversity of habitats is unheard of. I have not been very good at diving in Plymouth, but the little bit that I have done has been really special. The fact that you can literally jump off a seawall with the pub behind you and then, you know, swim out a little bit to go diving and see cuttlefish and octopus and all sorts of... It was amazing for such an urban dive, effectively. But we've got seagrass beds, we've got Drake's Island, which is amazing for bird life and all sorts of things. You've got two major rivers coming in, creating really interesting environments. Yeah, no, it's really cool. And I feel for students here and for staff, the fact that you can actually walk to so many of these environments from a teaching perspective or from a research perspective, we're so lucky. I mean, how many places can actually walk 20 minutes and actually, you know, you walk through the city in your wellies to go on a field trip? You know, there's not many places you can be in the world to do that. Yeah, so it's a really special place. But if I was to name one place that I really like to go in Plymouth Sound, do you know what? King Sand and Caw Sand.
Yeah.
Over there. I mean, just the villages are beautiful anyway. The shore is really cool. And then if you get the boat ride over from the Barbican,
yeah,
it's just like, we live here, really? that would probably be one of my favourites. Yeah.
Do you think Plymouth is leading the way in conservation, not only in research, but also like conservation of the marine environment?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's a reason people come to work here. It's a global centre for marine everything, including conservation. Yes, I am biased. I do work here. But I chose to work here. I could have, I didn't grow up here. I chose to come here. It is world leading, and it's a special place. I think the fact that just recently, this year, Plymouth Sound has been named the first national marine park in the UK says a huge amount. And that's not saying that it's off limits to human beings. Modern conservation, of course, includes human beings, and we're a part of the conservation story. So yeah, no, I would say we are leading. And we've got some amazing researchers here in Plymouth, all doing wonderful work.
And you're part of them. Well, thank you so much, Louise, for taking the time to do that episode with me.
No, you're welcome. It was a pleasure. Thanks, Louise.
Thanks for listening to this episode, and I hope you've enjoyed it. Louise has been one of my lecturers at uni, and it's actually really great to spend that moment with her and actually getting to know more about what she's doing for research. I think we got to a point where it is time to reconciliate human and the living world and stop disconnecting us that much. I think eco-engineering is a powerful way to reconciliate both sides. If you're interested in her work with eco-engineering and you want to know more, I've put some links in the description. And if you want to say anything about the episode or the show in general, or if you want to give feedback, please reach out. I'd love to hear from you. And if not, then keep your eyes open for the next episode in 2 weeks, which will bring us underwater to discover marine life in Plymouth. In the meantime, don't forget to take care of yourself and of the ocean.